this is what I love about AA meetings. I've been to many of them with many of my clients, and I love it because the armor comes off. The truth telling comes on, and it is so sacred.
Well, hello, friends of Bill W. and other friends. You have landed on Sober Speak. My name is John M. I am an alcoholic, and we are glad you are all here, especially newcomers. Newcomers, that is, both to recovery as a whole and newcomers to this podcast. Sober Speak is a podcast about recovery centered around the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. My job here on Sober Speak is simple. My job is to provide a platform to the amazing stories of recovery all around us. Consider Sober Speak, if you will, your meeting between meetings. Please remember, we do not speak for AA or any 12-step community. We represent only ourselves. We are here to share our experience, strength, and hope with those who wish to come along for the ride. Take what you want and leave the rest at the curb for the trash man to pick up. That was the voice of Miss Vanessa Sanford that you heard at the beginning of this episode today. And this episode is one in which I would call it, I'm coloring outside the lines. I had been asked, or several requests had been put in, for me to record an episode with a non-alcoholic, maybe a counselor, somebody outside the program of AA. So that is what we have here today with Miss Vanessa. And if you read any of the AA history and the traditions, you will see that our history is shot full of non-alcoholics that we have leaned on for guidance and counsel and feedback. And that's what I'm doing in this particular case. Just wanted to have somebody in with a little bit of a different perspective. So, you know, I have been to counselors during sobriety, and I will tell you that from my perspective, good counselors are worth their weight in gold. And Vanessa is one of those. She is actually a fantastic counselor. We're going to talk about several subjects. We'll talk about shame. We're going to address the stigma of mental illness. We're going to talk about the power of resilience. And my favorite part of this whole episode is when we did a breathing and relaxation exercise that she did with me, actually during the podcast. Absolutely loved it. I could have done that for like 60 minutes, but you guys would be bored out of your gourd. Nonetheless, I hope you enjoy it. I'm going to have many links that I'm putting in the show notes here. We talk about several subjects. I'm going to give you also a link to Vanessa's website if you need to get in touch with her. But first things first, before we get into the episode, and this episode is brought to you by Jim and Kimberly. Jim and Kimberly went to our website, soberspeak.com, clicked on the donate tab, and made a contribution. Jim and Kimberly, thank you so, so much for your generous contribution. This episode is for you. We're going to let everybody else listen in, but this episode is for you. Now, just a little bit of listener feedback. Jennifer H. writes in. She said, "Hey, John." Hi, John, actually, is what she said, but I don't think you'll really care one way or another. "Hi, John. My name is Jennifer H., and I live in Northern California. I have been sober for 100 days today." Great, Jennifer. That's absolutely fantastic. "I first heard about Sober Speak during your interview on the Bubble Hour. I am a married working mother of three, and love to listen to your podcast during the many hours I spend in the car. I am very blessed to have a wonderful home group, but you are truly my, quote, meeting between meetings, unquote. Thank you for all of your work in spreading the message. It has made a tremendous impact on my life and recovery. God bless you, Jennifer H. Thank you so much for writing in. I sure do appreciate it there in Northern California. We're glad to have you listening in." Kim writes in. Kim says, "Good morning, John. Exclamation point. I am Kim C., an alcoholic and addict from Great Falls, Virginia. And my sobriety date is 11/21/2016. I've been around the room since the 80s and starting with Alateen. I have had long periods of not drinking, but not true sobriety until now. I discovered SoberSpeak when the radio in my car stopped working. My car has developed some quirky electrical issues, the radio being one of them. I listen on my commute to and fro work, and I'm getting so much from your meeting between meetings. I always hear things relevant to me and my sobriety, no matter who the speaker is. Your podcast let me be in the, quote, rooms, unquote, whenever I find myself. A quick escape from my extended family not in recovery at Christmas and some headphones gave me a breathe deep, seek peace time. Thank you for the time and effort that you put into carrying the message. Gratefully, Kim C. of Great Falls, Virginia. Well, if you're out there in Great Falls, Virginia, and you run across Kim C., please give her a great big hug for me. To all of you writing in, a big old virtual hug for you. By the way, I would never wish ill will on your electrical work in your car and your radio. But in this case, I'm actually glad it happened because you found us at SoberSpeak. And I'm glad we could provide some needed relief at Christmas from the not in recovery family. That's absolutely fantastic. Okay, so this week we published Rebecca commented on Instagram. Rebecca wrote in and she said, "John, just started listening to your podcast, randomly found it on Spotify. I'm 88 days sober, working on my first set of steps, and go to meetings almost daily. Love the podcast, and I am subscribed. You have a new loyal listener!" Exclamation point. Rebecca, thanks for listening in. I'm glad you found us randomly on Spotify. Catherine writes in, and she wrote this after listening to David G's Steps 1, 2, and 3 episode. It's the episode right before this, episode number 60 or 61. But anyway, David G's Steps 1, 2, and 3 is what it's called. And she said, "John, I constantly need the reinforcement of the importance of steps 1, 2, and 3. When life throws me a curveball, I get in touch with my flaws and focus on step 3. With the help of AA tools, podcasts like SoberSpeak, and my HP, I am equipped to gain back my sanity. Thank you, John, for all the subjects that you present and discuss. Each one speaks to me in a language that I wouldn't always hear at my home group. Small miracles are revealed in your interviews, and for that I am truly blessed and greatly appreciative. Here's to another informative and insightful year ahead in 2019. Thank you so much, Catherine, for writing in and those wonderful comments. By the way, I did have somebody else ask me last week, if I would be willing to not only do steps 1, 2, and 3 with David, but we would be willing to follow up with 4 through 12, and we're going to break those up in some form or fashion. But I've already talked to David about that, and we're going to do basically, I guess, what you would call a step study. We posted, and when I say we, I just want to say this. I put out a shout out, 4 or 5 weeks ago to anybody who would be willing to help me with some social media work, because, you know, I have a full-time job and I love doing this podcast, but I just don't have the time to do everything that I want to do. And Miss Cassandra wrote in. Miss Cassandra is an Al-Anon. She had been listening to SoberSpeak. She wrote in and said that she would be willing to, in her spare time, to help me with some things. And she has gone way, way beyond the call of duty. And most of what you see posted on Instagram now is coming directly from Cassandra, all the graphics, and I just can't thank her enough. It has been absolutely fantastic. And if you're not following me on Instagram right now, go to at SoberSpeak, all one word. But Cassandra had heard me say this in one of the previous episodes, and she posted this question. It says, if you could rent out a billboard and advertise something regarding recovery that you wanted people who were struggling to see, what would it say? And I got three responses, and here it is. It says, Katie says, sobriety is like wiping clean a foggy mirror. You can see yourself clearly again. Peace sign and heart. I love it, Katie. It is like wiping away a foggy mirror. Liz wrote in and she said, no matter how good or bad you feel, it will not last forever. And that's true. It won't last forever. And you know, you have a tendency to think, especially when you're in those bad times, that it is going to last forever. But very well put, Liz. And Catherine writes in a very short, succinct, and I love this. Old ways will not open new doors. All right. So I think that's enough for now. Thank you, Catherine, for writing that in as well. And if you want to contact me directly via email, at least, you can reach out to me at feedback@soberspeak.com. That comes right to me. You can actually also write to john@soberspeak.com. They go right to the same place. And now we were on to Miss Vanessa Sanford. Enjoy. Okay, everybody. So today we are sitting here with Miss Vanessa Sanford. And I want to say right off the bat, you noticed that I said her last name. I don't think I've said the last name of anybody appearing on this podcast in the past. And that is because it's a little bit different today. And what I mean by different is Vanessa is not one of us, so to speak. She is not an alcoholic. She is a counselor. And I'm going to go through real quickly here how I met her, and then I'm going to let her, and we're going to turn it over to her and let her speak about some subjects dear to her heart. Well, I met Vanessa. By the way, go ahead and say hello, Vanessa.
Hello.
I met Vanessa. She was at the church that I attend here in Frisco, Texas. And I work with the youth a lot up at our church. And Vanessa came in to share she was one of the counselors that came in and shared 1 week about, it was a suicide prevention week, basically for junior high and high school mm-hmm. students in our community. Because there's been some challenges with that. I mean, not only challenges here, but challenges everywhere. But and she did such a great job of presenting to us, the parents. She was talking to us, the parents, that she just really stood out to me. And I wanted to have her in on the podcast today. So, in fact, Vanessa talked about during that session something that I still use in my life. This was about the kids, but I was like thinking, oh, this is for adults. I mean, this is great information. One thing that she shared about is she shared about walking through Target and making up stories in her head about what other people are thinking or what they may be thinking, and about how we all have stories that we make up in our head about what other people are thinking or saying. Is that all right? Right, Vanessa?
That's right. We do.
So I wanted to have her in. I've had several requests from other people that I know that are in the program to have in somebody that is not an alcoholic. And those of you who have been around for a long time within the 12-step community and within Alcoholics Anonymous, you know that our literature is fraught with suggestions and ideas that we do reach out to people that are not in the program. And so Vanessa is here today, and I'm so glad you're here, Miss Vanessa.
Thank you. Thank you, John.
You're welcome. So, Lizzie, why don't you go ahead and just give like a little bit of a background on yourself so folks can know who you are, and we'll take it from there.
Sure. My name's Vanessa, and I also live in Frisco, Texas, and I am a licensed professional counselor, have a private practice here. But really what's so important about the why I'm here to talk is, I love stories. I believe in them. I believe in the power of resilience. That's one of my favorite words. And ever since I was little, I've been chasing that word. And you know, a lot of people ask me, why did I get into this field? Well, I really am a curious person that chases resilience. So when I see those experiences, I want to know more. And so I've had lots of really neat experiences working at Children's Medical Center in the inpatient psych unit. I learned a lot there. Nothing that my master's program taught me in books. It was all experience led. I also worked in research at UT Southwestern Medical School and hated it. I am not one to just, I got in trouble for calling them subject. I mean, for not calling them subjects. And they told me I care too much about the subjects.
Oh, the subjects are the people
the
that
people,
you're caring
yeah.
for.
And I was like, oh, I was really interested in their stories instead of just having them fill out applications and doing the study. So, I just knew it wasn't my fit. Cool. And then I worked in my internship to earn my license, in a bunch of places, Parkland Oncology, which was beautiful. I got to sit with people getting chemo and just sit with them and hear their stories. Mm-hmm. And it was one of the most amazing experiences I've ever had. And then I worked at, Betty Ford Five Star Kids Program, and it's a it's a group for, children of addicts. And so I got to work with kids really trying to, create some layers of protection so that they don't continue in the cycle of addiction that's been going on in their family.
And what's that called? Betty Ford. Five Star.
Mm-hmm. Five Star Kids. Yeah.
Wow.
And they had, a location in Texas for over 20 years. They just closed their doors and have moved to Minnesota, but one of the best jobs I've ever had. It was amazing.
Very interesting.
And it was fun. You know, we're talking about addiction, but it was fun. We made it kid friendly. And then I worked at the Dallas Children's Advocacy Center, where we specialized in children that were abused and, in all the aspects in court, and working with their families, working with their own healing. And it was an amazing, hard, dramatic, love-filled job that I just will never forget.
Wow.
And I was, part of this really cool alliance. It's still going on. It's a really long name, but it's the Texas Alliance for Drug Endangered Children. I was a part of that. We traveled all over the state to educate professionals on understanding the impact of addiction on children. So, I have done lots of fun things. I still have lots of fun things to do, but that's some background for me.
And there's another piece that I've heard you talk about before. I believe that you're getting, and this is kind of near and dear to my heart. In other words, if you look behind you in our room,
yes,
here,
I know what you're talking about.
I have yoga mats and all kinds of yoga stuff over there, blocks, et cetera, straps. My understanding is that you're getting a yoga certification. Is that
I
right?
I am.
What is that called?
I am. It's called psychotherapeutic yoga instructor.
Really?
It's so exciting. I love yoga. And actually, when I was working at the Advocacy Center, I received a free month pass to yoga. And I don't know if you have tried different kinds of yoga, but it was a free month pass to Bikram yoga.
Right, the hot yoga.
Oh, yeah. 105 degrees, 90 minutes. That was my first class, and I loved it. I stunk, and it was like so much sweat releasing from me, but it was the most cathartic experience I've ever had. So I loved it. And that was in 2005. And I was just hooked, since, and, have really found that there's, such power in movement and in our body instead of just in our mouths and talking. And I've, was so interested in finding, a training that can offer that. So I'm still learning. I've still got a lot to, earn to finish, but, so far it has been, so much experience.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
Yeah. A lady who I love in our group, her name's Kate. She is a hot yoga teacher.
Oh, yeah.
I think it's one of like Sunstone Yoga or mm-hmm. something like that. And she mm-hmm. really enjoys it.
Yeah.
Okay. So that makes sense. So, okay. Let's, I guess, shift gears here a little bit. As you know, when we've talked about prior to this, you know, the majority of the people listening to this are going to be Alcoholics Anonymous or 12-step members. And so my interest in having you in here is to talk about, I guess, your counseling experience, if you will, and how that relates to alcoholism, addiction, what you see in your practice. We can kind of take it, I guess, subject by subject. Mm-hmm. I know that one of the things that you are passionate about mm-hmm. and very learned on is the subject of shame. Mm-hmm. So why don't you kind of explain what you see, first of all, define shame, what it is, what it isn't, mm-hmm. and then talk about how you see it relating to Alcoholics Anonymous, how you see it relating to addiction.
Yeah. Easy question, John. So one of the things that I did back in 2013 is I got certified in Brené Brown's work. And I'm not sure if you're familiar, John, with her, but she is a force. And she has done so much research on shame and shame resilience. So the things I'm going to talk about is from her and her research and my time training with her and her group. And so what I've learned from her about shame, it's human emotion. Everybody experiences it. And she'll say the only ones that don't experience shame are the ones that, are maybe psychopaths and have no ability to care for others. So if you have hurt feelings, if you feel, some level of struggle or worthiness, then you probably have experienced shame. And what she talks about, and this is something near and dear to me, is, because it's a human emotion, it's so uncomfortable to feel. And what she says is shame is a full contact emotion. So you viscerally feel it. It can knock you down. And what the definition that she describes is, it is a place where you feel unworthy, unloved, not good enough. And I think that's a human thing. I think we all have moments of that. And why shame is such an important topic in relation to addiction, what she teaches is that shame is highly correlated with addiction, with suicide, with aggression, with violence, with self-harm, with eating disorders, with depression, with anxiety. I mean, it can really get corrosive in our lives if we don't understand why we have shame and why it's taking over our lives. And why that's so important is if shame is leading our lives, we are desperately trying to find places to numb and hide from it.
Okay, so give me an example of shame mm-hmm. leading my life. Mm-hmm. What would that look like?
So for a moment of feeling rejected, just think of a moment for, and one of the things she'll talk about is this. For women, one of the biggest shame triggers is our bodies. Feeling like the only worthiness and value we can offer is what we look like. And that can be such a shame trigger if our bodies aren't like what they're supposed to look like on magazines.
And for guys, I would mm-hmm. imagine it would be something like what kind of providers we may be.
Well, she says the biggest shame trigger for men is perceptions of weakness. Which can definitely tap into what you're saying of not being a provider. But yeah, it can really, to appear weak as a man is a spiral of shame for sure. And both of those play out all the time, in movies, in, all these stories that we listen to and that are advertised. So it's in our consciousness and our culture all the time. It's hard to unwrap ourselves from it.
That's right.
Yeah.
Okay. So you said shame, you know, and how it plays out in our lives. Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit about, I guess, what shame, I think shame can get confused with other emotions sometimes. Mm-hmm. Talk to me a little bit about that.
Yeah. There's three emotions that usually gets, confused with. And the main one is guilt. A lot of people say they feel shame when really what they're describing is guilt. And the reason why it's important to untangle these emotions, it's not a linguistics issue. Guilt is actually a healthy feeling. If I feel guilty about a behavior that I chose to do, I'm more motivated to change the behavior. But if I feel shame for who I am, it's hard for me to change who I am. And so if I feel guilt, it's positive because I'm more willing to do something about it. But if I feel shame, what's the most common response that I've learned is we go and hide. We go and avoid. It's too big to change.
Can you give me an example of what that looks like in real life, shame and guilt, so people can kind of wrap their brain around that a little more?
Yeah. If I'm not feeling good enough, if I'm feeling unworthy, if I'm feeling unloved, and then somebody says, you're so pretty, or you are such a good person, I don't believe them. I think they're lying. I think that they're just trying to be nice, or I think they're being deceitful, or I just think they're making things up because I don't feel like I deserve that. And when I mess up, when I screw up, my self-talk is, I'm such an idiot. I'm so stupid. I can't believe somebody would love me. And then I'm more willing to make choices that align with that view of myself.
Okay. So that's shame, right?
That's shame.
Okay. I may be getting ahead of you here, but where does that come from? Why do we, I mean, and I don't know if you know the answer to this, but you know, where does that come from? And then how do we get past that, if you will?
I think, you know, what I've learned, I don't have an answer for everybody, but kind of my theory is we come wired. We can live in a household full of love, or full of trauma, and our wiring can get triggered, by shame or by self-worth. It just, you know, we can have siblings and we can have the same parents, same household, same environment. And one of us may become an addict and one of us may not. We come wired. And so, it depends on our self-talk. It depends on how we are talked to as children, and how we're role modeled, how to struggle and how to get back up. I think a lot of us are just told to be quiet, and get over it and figure it out. And I don't know what that means. I need details and I need steps. And when I'm told to go to my room, or I'm a big problem, then I may believe that I'm a big problem and I'll look for ways to align with that I'm a big problem. And that's shame.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. So that's what shame looked like. And you were talking about shame and kind of giving an example of that. What would be more like guilt? Because guilt is more of an appropriate kind of emotion. Am I right?
Yes. Okay. I mean, that's our hope. And when I work with families, when I work with kids and teenagers, my hope is that if they have shame talk, that we will progress to guilt talk. Meaning if they did something, instead of saying, I'm so stupid, they can say, I made a stupid choice.
Gotcha.
Because my worthiness should not be shifted based on my choices. It should just be, I'm worthy as is. I don't have any prerequisites. I'm just enough. And I may make dumb choices, but I'm going to work to make better choices. But I don't have to be anybody. I don't have to lessen my value of myself because of choices I've made. That's my hope.
Right.
But with guilt, that's the hope, is the self-talk is, I made a dumb choice, but I'm still enough.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. So I, you know, came from and I don't want to make this all my story here, but I came from a background that had, I was an only child, had a mother who was mentally ill. She had several things going on. She had anorexia. She had bulimia. She had OCD. I mean, true OCD. And there was all kinds of things going on. And the only reason I'm saying that is because when I was a kid, no one ever talked about any of this kind of stuff. There was stigma around it. All I knew is it was weird, if you will. So I would imagine part of dealing with some of these issues for you in your work, either with alcoholics or non-alcoholics, is kind of getting past the stigma. And so how do you get people past that?
You know, I always have parents so eager for their children to get better. And I remind them that paying me and driving and having their child in a session for an hour once a week is not enough. because I will never be as much of an impact as the parents. And so I explain that this isn't the medical model. In a medical model, you bring your insurance card, you set up an appointment, you pay, and the doctor does what they do quickly. They assess the symptoms and then they move on. In therapy, it is a family approach. And what happens is the work in a session is not as important as the work that gets led into the home and integrated. We cannot be more resilient than our children. If we want our children to become resilient, we have to get into these hard conversations. We have to get into not just paying somebody to have the conversations, but to doing them at home and practicing role modeling. And so if I want my kids to be shame resilient, to be brave, to have hard conversations, I can't expect them to do that in their room on their own, or with a professional. I've got to do that myself.
Yeah.
And the things I talk about in here, they're not just things that I'm a professional helping other families. I have to do this too. I screw it up all the time. I have shame all the time that I have to check and transition it to guilt talk. And there's a lot of work that I do every day. And just because I'm a professional does not mean I do not struggle. So whatever stigma around that, we got to let go of real quick. And there's a lot of it, especially around helping professionals. So as far as the stigma goes, I want to say two things really quick just about the words that get tangled with shame and then play into the stigma. So guilt is one that gets tangled up. And then humiliation is another one. And the difference between shame and humiliation is one thing. When we feel humiliated, we don't believe we deserved it. And that's so huge because there's a story that I learned when I was learning all of this stuff about a kid in school. And they had forgotten to put their name on a paper. And the teacher was passing out all the graded papers. And she said, who didn't put their name on the paper? And this student did not want to raise their hand and say they didn't put their name on the paper. And the teacher said, well, I know who it is. Let me put your name on the paper for you. And she spelled out stupid and put that as the kid's name.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. And so here's the thing about humiliation. If this student felt humiliated, then she would have thought, I didn't deserve this. I'm going to go tell my parents. There's going to be emails. There's going to be meetings. There will be discussions. They would feel upset about what happened because they didn't fully believe they deserved it. And what's so important about humiliation is you are worthy and you know that that treatment is wrong. And so you're going to speak up about it. When you feel shame and that's your leading emotion, what would have happened in that class, there's no news to tell. It's just confirmation that that's true. Yep, I am stupid. She called me stupid. There's no news. And so when parents say, why didn't you say anything, right? If they're already feeling shame and something happens that they feel more shame in, what's there to say?
Right.
And so humiliation is important because we want people, when they mistreat us, we want to understand it's not okay. And not just it's not okay, but we need to speak up about it.
Mm-hmm.
And shame will stop that from happening. We will just say it's another story to confirm we're not enough, which is why shame can be really corrosive in our lives.
Right.
And then we want to find hiding places like addiction to numb. And then the last one that we get tangled up is embarrassment. And embarrassment is the lighter of all of these emotions. It's fleeting. It's like a booger, or you got toilet paper hanging off your shoe, or you forget to zip your pants up, or you got things in your food in your teeth. And what's interesting about embarrassment is after a while, it's funny. And the other part about embarrassment is, you know, other people have experienced it. So, you know, you're not alone. So it's like, man, remember when I had that booger? It was so embarrassing, but now it's funny. But shame will never be funny.
Right.
And so, this is why it's so important to separate these. And what's interesting, John, is you and I may have the same experience and you may walk away feeling embarrassed and I may walk away feeling shame. Depending on our wiring, our belief systems, our experiences before that specific one will kind of conform us in how we take that story.
So tell me about the psyche. Okay. Well, first of all, let me do a little metro announcement here, then we'll continue on. Okay. So we'll be continuing our conversation with Vanessa Sanford in just a moment. Just a reminder, you're listening to Sober Speak. You can find us on the web at www.soberspeak.com. There you will find all of our back episodes at this point. There's over 50, somewhere between 50 and 60. You can also find the donate button on our website. Only if the spirit moves you to do such, you can use it. Please keep in mind, this podcast is funded by you, the listener. Sober Speak is a self-supporting organization through our own contributions. We are not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. We do not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorse nor oppose any causes. Okay, now back to Miss Vanessa. So what I'm thinking about it is when you're talking is I'm looking at and thinking about somebody who was in their youth who went through some sort of abusive sort of situation. And it's happening more and more, as you know now, or, you know, there's just a large segment of the population that has occurred to. And then they get to be an adult. And something happens, and I can't quite put words to this. I'm hoping you can help me out. But they, for what they went through, somehow, and it doesn't make sense logically, but it makes sense emotionally and spiritually, I guess. They start to develop shame over that incident that took place with them when they were a kid. So can you take me through that process and why people experience that?
Well, you know, I don't know for everybody, but kind of what my experience has been just in my own life, and then even with, you know, the people that I serve, what I learn is shame is part of the language at home. It's not spoken, it's silent. And here's what shame needs to thrive. It needs silence, it needs secrets, and it needs judgment. So I'll say that again. What shame needs to thrive is silence, secrets, and judgment. And if those are part of your family language, it's gonna be strong. It's gonna be powerful. And whether we're kids, whether we're adults, shame is very effective.
And you just struck a chord with me, because when I was a kid, I never talked about what was going on.
Of course
with my
not.
Mom.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. Never.
Right.
And it came out sideways as I went into my, you know, late teens and 20s, especially.
Yeah.
And I could tell you that we try with our kids. I'm sure we're not perfect, right? We're not perfect parents. We don't have perfect kids. But we try to instill in them that we're not keeping the secret, right? Let's talk about, I mean, there's appropriate people to talk to it about, you know, you don't want to, you know, people know about fifth steps in the program. I don't go to a meeting and do a fifth step at every meeting, you know, but I can tell you for sure that, if God were to punch my clock tomorrow, I don't have any secrets and, you know, I've gotten it out there in some form or fashion. But anyway, silence and secrets and judgment. So what do those look like to you? The silence, secrets, and judgment?
Well, I mean, secrets make us sick for sure. And that's one of the rules in addiction is keeping things a secret. And think about it, right? In our culture, when somebody's in pain, we all suck at handling other people's pain.
Right.
We say really silly things to them that mean nothing to them, but we think they're helpful. Things like it'll get better, or it's going to be okay, or, you know, God has a plan for everything, or at least they're not suffering anymore, or, but you were a kid and now you're an adult, so you should be over it by now. Or I know they died last year, but you know, it's been a year, so can you wrap this up? Or you're still bothered by that? Or, oh, you're bothered by that? Well, you should hear my story. That's more painful than your story. I mean, we as adults really need more social skills in how to handle pain. And so when we think about that, that's judgment, right? That silences the other person. And that makes people be secret keeping. Why would I share something with somebody that's vulnerable and painful if I'm told it's not a good enough story to validate somebody's empathy, somebody's care, somebody's time? That's what we're taught all the time. Oh, get over it. Deal with it. Suck it up.
That's right. Yeah. Pull yourself up by your own bootstraps.
That's right. And so this is what makes shame so powerful. And I think about Gregory Boyle. I don't know if you've ever heard of him before, but he is a priest out in L.A., and he's well known for his service with the L.A. gangs. He helps them transition out of gangs into jobs and education. And he's a remarkable man. And what he talks about is, you know, people don't join gangs because they're full of hope. And I think about that with addiction. People don't join this club of addiction because they're full of hope. I think, and I may be speaking too generally, but I think a lot of people join addiction slowly, obviously, because they're full of pain. Mm-hmm. And it's a hiding place. Mm-hmm. And for you know, a little bit of time, they don't have to feel the things that hurt them.
And it actually works.
It's very effective.
Right. In the Absolutely. Beginning, it works yeah. even better.
Absolutely.
And then eventually the solution doesn't work anymore. Right. And then you're stuck because right. you're addicted. And
yes. And, you know, one of the things Brené talks about is we are the most in debt, overweight, medicated, addicted U.S. adult cohort in history. We numb. All of us numb. Not all of us are addicts, but every human numbs. And so I'd never want to just think of this as siloed or fragmented for addicts. We all numb. We all don't like feeling pain, and we all try to find hiding places from it. With food, with sex, with drugs, with alcohol, with social media, with gossip, with constant change. I mean, whatever we do, we can find a way to chronically use it.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. So I want to kind of shift gears here a little bit. As we were coming into the, mm-hmm. into the room here and we were having our mm-hmm. talk, you were mentioning that you had listened to Megan.
Yes.
On the previous episode.
Yes.
And just in case you're wondering, oh, that's Megan P. And I think it's called, oh, I'm not looking at it. Recovery Promise, excuse me, Recovery Promises What Alcohol Gives. No, that's not it at all. I'm completely butchering that, but I'm very close. I think it's all the words. They're just jumbled. So anyway, but Megan P. did we had a great time with her. And when she came in here last time to do a recording, she did a Reiki session, Reiki, I think is how you pronounce it, with me and my wife. Mm-hmm. And so you had mentioned that you have a breathing mm-hmm. technique
yeah.
that you think, are you learning this through your yoga practitioner?
I actually learned it from somebody else certified in this work from Brené Brown. But I've been using it as a student getting certified. I have led a 6-week yoga class already. And so I got to make it all up. It was really fun. And so it was part yoga, part Brené Brown work. And at the end of every class, we would close with this breathing practice.
Okay.
And so I'd love to share.
Yeah.
That with
so
you guys.
I don't know exactly how this is going to play out. We're doing this on the fly here. And I think you were going to use me as a mm-hmm. subject on this.
Yes.
Is that correct? All right.
Yes. And you will be the subject, and whoever else listening would like to join in.
Yeah. Now, if you're driving, please pull your car over.
Well, and I'll say this before I start. One of the things that led me to this is there's a woman named Roshi Joan Halifax, and she's a Buddhist monk. And she talks about how important it is for us to inhale for ourselves because we exhale for others all the time. And so thinking about a lot of us, especially helpers, me included, and probably many listening, when we are servants of others all the time. And so we're exhaling all the time, doing for others. And the inhale is for our own breath, our own needs, our own self-love. And so being able to practice both for ourselves can really balance us.
Do you have by any chance, a link that you could provide me to her like a website or her mm-hmm. work or some
yeah.
of this? And that way I can put it in the show notes.
Absolutely.
And if anybody wants to pause yeah. their device, go down the show notes, they'll be able to click on that. I'm also, just so you all know out there, I'm going to put a link to Vanessa and her work, and if you want to reach out to her, and you know, and I've said this before on the show, but just so you know, I don't particularly endorse anything, but I want to put the knowledge out there, and if you all want to contact Vanessa, you're more than welcome to do that. So, all right, so what am I going to do here, Ms. Vanessa?
All right, John. So make sure both feet are on the floor.
Okay.
Okay, feel your back in your chair.
Yep. Unfortunately, I got a straight back chair here.
You can place your hands on your lap or wherever you feel comfortable. You can close your eyes, or if that's not comfortable for you, you can just lower them to a soft gaze. And I just want you to notice your body. I want you to notice the tension in your neck and shoulders and just lower that. I want you to lower the roof, the tongue from the roof of the mouth. Untighten your eyebrows, unlock your jaw, and just notice your body in the chair. And as you inhale and exhale, in your own time, try to inhale and exhale in the same amount. And I'm just going to guide you with this breathing practice. It's called self-care breathing practice. And as you inhale, you can follow along. And as you exhale, there's some directions. So breathe in connected. Breathe out divided. Breathe in clear. Breathe out distorted. Breathe in focused. Breathe out scattered. Breathe in wise. Breathe out not knowing. Breathe in relaxed, breathe out stressed. Breathe in gratitude, breathe out scarcity. Breathe in calm, breathe out fear. Breathe in loving, breathe out hatred. Breathe in peaceful, breathe out worry. Breathe in permission. Breathe out doubt. Just for now, breathe. Take another breath in and out, inhaling what you'd like to hold on to and exhaling what you'd like to let go of. Wiggle your toes and fingers and come back into the room.
Okay, I can't go down and take a nap, right? Because I'm actually in the middle of this podcast. Is that correct?
That is correct.
All right, so I'm going to have to kind of come back here more quickly than I would like. I still have my eyes closed because I'm trying to hold on to every ounce of this that I can. So your voice and the words together combined and the tone of your voice is a very good combination for this kind of work. And, you know, as you were going through all those breathe in and breathe out the various adjectives, and I was thinking about, we have something in our literature called the St. Francis Prayer. It was created by St. Francis, right. But it's in the 11th step and the 12 and 12 and it has, you know, like the opposites, mm-hmm. Just like you did. And I was thinking that somebody could take that same prayer, same meditation, but it is like a prayer to me. It's like both. They could take those words and transpose them and put them into that reading, and that would be fantastic. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and I'm guessing maybe if you're in an actual yoga class, you probably extend that out a little bit further. Mm-hmm. But you know, mm-hmm. with me and you here being in the middle of this, I mean, but this was absolutely fantastic. Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. I love it.
All right, so what have we not covered that you want to make sure that we cover before we wrap up here? What subjects are, you know, top of mind for you? What do you think that the listeners could benefit from hearing here that maybe we haven't covered yet?
Just a couple things. I wanted to circle back about stigma, because one of the things that it's just a soapbox that I'll probably be on for a long time as an advocate for mental health and shame resilience. is when we have an injury from our neck down, when we have cancer or a broken bone or a spleen issue, man, we get casseroles and prayer chains and visits and flowers. And we get lots of support. And there is zero shame in the support, it feels like. And that's probably judgmental to say it in zero shame, but less shame. But when we have an illness or some medical issue from our neck up in our brain, whether it's a mental illness or an addiction, man, it's silence. We don't get flowers or casseroles or cards or prayer chains. We get silence and we get told really, unfortunately, more shaming things like it's all in your head. Or get over it, or you should be stronger, or you're not praying hard enough, or you're not a big believer.
Those are tough ones. You're not praying hard enough, and you're not a big believer. I mean, they're all bad. But
they're all bad. But to braid in your spirituality,
right? It's like
taking a medical issue.
Right.
Ouch. You would never say that to somebody with cancer.
It's like taking a whether you worship the Quran or the Bible or whatever you worship, it's like weaponizing that literature against you.
That's right. And the more we understand about stigma, and the more we understand that when we speak with stigma instead of speaking with love, we are silencing people that are in pain. And addiction is really comforting and saying, hey, come over here. I'll be with you. I'm predictable. You know what to expect from me. And we're unpredictable as humans because we are not great in tolerating pain in ourselves and in others. So stigma is a big one that I try to explain because it can really create barriers to healing and resilience. And we all need it. The other thing that I was just going to say, just not even about stigma, but just understanding that because I'm a counselor, I want to just say that I don't think therapy is always the option. I think sometimes in the medical field and the mental health field, there's too much pathology. And I'm not a fan of speaking about people that I work with.
So what do you mean by that? Too much pathology?
Too much pathology, meaning if you've ever walked into a doctor's office or a therapist's office, or you have heard somebody on TV say, I'm working with... I've got a bipolar client, or I've got an addict next, or you're labeled by your struggle. Ouch. No thanks. I'm not interested in that. I try to look at people as whole people. And it's part of our story, but it's not our whole story. And so I am not a fan to label someone as their diagnosis. So I will say I'm working with somebody who struggles with XYZ instead of I'm working with depression.
Right.
And that's part of the stigma too, is all the pathology. Or even when I work with parents sometimes or clients, sometimes they want to just focus on the wrong, that we need to spend lots of time on the wrong. Which, in our brain, we're real clear on finding what's wrong, because it's a survival mechanism. But to create pathways for health, we have to practice looking for what's right. Mm-hmm. And that's a big practice in our brain to create pathways to find and expand our views so that we're not just honed in on the wrong, and our family members not looking at us that way or our community looking at us that way. So I think about, gratitude, and I think about joy, and I think about ways to look at a moment, and not just in the pain, but also notice the connection and the sharing, even if it's painful. This is what I love about AA meetings. I've been to many of them with many of my clients, and I love it because the armor comes off. The truth telling comes on, and it is so sacred.
Yeah, a friend of mine, actually, his name is Eric. He's been on the podcast before. He refers to AA as the opposite of Facebook.
It's so true. That's hilarious.
You don't see people posting their pictures of when they drove the car through the kitchen online, you know?
Right.
This is the day I ruined Christmas, you know, all that sort of stuff. It's all the...
It's wonderful. AA meetings are wonderful. I'm a big fan of therapy, obviously, not just as a servant, but also doing my own work. But I just love the idea of it's a place, it's a safe place to tell the truth mm-hmm. instead of an unsafe place to lie and pretend and fake and hide. Yeah.
The other thing that I actually wanted to cover with you before you got out of here was the subject of trust. And, mm-hmm. and when I say trust, you know, I think about myself coming into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, this is not a story that's just unique to me. Still even today, you know, I'd be naive to think that my past did not affect me, you know, and you get kind of jaded. You don't know who to trust. You don't know how to trust. There's a saying that, in God we trust, but all of us pay cash. So when you work with clients and they, even coming into you, I'm mm-hmm. sure they have a hard time trusting yeah. you. Like, what is this lady going to do with this information? Mm-hmm. Talk to me a little bit about trust.
Ooh, it's sacred. I think that there's two relationships with trust. Your trust in yourself and your trust in others. And I think the biggest casualty when we struggle is our own loss of self-trust. When we're in pain, when we're in conflict, when we're in shame, when we do something that doesn't work out in the story that we had hoped, we have movies in our heads about how things will go. Our biggest casualties is our own loss of self-trust. I'm not enough. I'm stupid. I shouldn't have done it. All the shoulds, mm-hmm. And coulds and woulds. And you know, I always tell people not to shit on themselves. But, you know, trust is sacred. And what I've learned through Brené and John Gottman and a bunch of other leaders that I study is trust is built in small moments. It's not this grandiose, I'm coming in, saving you from a burning house, although that's very trustworthy in itself. It's ordinary and small. And it's a moment that when I see somebody struggling, whether it's a family member or somebody I work with, if I see it and I walk past it and don't acknowledge it, that's a moment where I've created distrust. Because they have not been seen, and I saw it and I ignored it. And think about when somebody you know is going through a hard time and they're calling you and you go, oh, I just don't want to talk to them right now. That's a moment, right? Instead of just going, they need me, I need to pick it up and deal with this. This is hard, but I've got to be here and show up.
Right.
So it's just understanding how malleable it is. And it's such a big concept. And Brené even brings up, there's an anatomy of trust. It's little things to learn about trust because it's such a huge concept. And just a few of them would be boundaries, to know what's okay and not okay. And if you don't know, ask. That's trust building or trust breaking.
Right.
Another one would be accountability, which is a big one in recovery, is I've got to own my mistakes and not blame or say, hey, I'm sorry, but you started it and I'm only sorry for 10%, but you did 90%. That's not the accountability. That's trust building. So just thinking about things like that. But trust is big. And I've got to earn it with everybody that I work with. I don't ever expect it. And I'm not here as a, I know what to do, follow my lead. I'm just here holding space. A lot of times, if I just get out of their way and I just listen with love, people start to remember their worthiness in a room that's safe and full of trust and no armor needed. And then they can hear themselves and build their worth back up and walk away feeling like, oh yeah, I am okay. I am going to be resilient. I am going to choose a life that is more full of love and trust. Yeah, it's beautiful.
I love it. I love it. So Vanessa has been very cooperative through this recording, because what you don't know going on all around is Vanessa came over, and then our guy who gets squirrels out of the attic came over at the same time. And he's been making, you can't hear it. I don't think you could hear it on the podcast, but he's been crawling up in our attic, and Vanessa has stayed very focused, and I really appreciate that. I started to say, which is very interesting, and I kind of caught myself. I started to say, well, you know, when that truck of his pulls up outside and it says something like, you know, dead animal remover or something like that, I'm always thinking, what are the neighbors going to think, right? Mm-hmm. Now, that is some sort of form of shame that I should not have. You know, it's not about me, right? It's just one of these things that has to happen. So I really have appreciated your time here today, Miss Vanessa. This has been absolutely fantastic. I'm going to have Vanessa provide to me any links that she wants to provide me. And once again, I will put them in the show notes here for this particular episode. You know, some of them will be how to contact her. Some of them will be some of these other people that she mentioned actually during the recording of this. But I'm going to go ahead and close it out, as I always do, with page 164 of the Big Book. It says, abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to Him and to your fellows, which is interesting. That's what we were just talking about here today. Clear away the wreckage of your past, which is interesting. That's exactly what we were talking about here today. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then. Once again, thank you, Ms. Vanessa,
thank you,
being here. Bye-bye.